When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Whenever you're ready now.
Okay, so I'm going to pour myself a little more, and you can leave this part in. It's endearing to, well, I guess I could take the lid off. Hey, why don't you shut up, Jack? Production Jack. I'm going to start calling you that. You need a nickname. We should have a nickname for you. Production Jack?
I'm okay with it.
Yeah? It doesn't quite ring. I have a few more drinks. I'll decide on what to call you. So, and I'm open to suggestions. I lost my train of thought. Hey, everybody, on this week's episode of Whiskey Neat. This is the episode that we have been building towards as a show. Fred Noe was extremely, it was an extreme honor. I had so much fun with Morgan and Kevin and Caleb from Peerless and Jay Evans. This episode, though, we've known from the very beginning that we were going to be recording this episode. This is the, like, exciting. So Stuart Buchanan is the global brand ambassador for Benriach, Glenglassaugh, Glendronach. He is a Scotsman. He travels the world preaching the good word of single malt whiskeys. And we're here today to talk about these, Glendronach and Benriach, although we do touch on Glenglassaugh a bit. He's just a good guy. You know, I've met him a few months back. We kind of hung out for a little bit, and I just wanted to get him on and talk about, like, what they're doing. As many of you know, that for the past couple of years, Glendronach 15 was discontinued, which was a huge fan favorite. Everyone loved Glendronach 15, and they're bringing it back. They're bringing it back this year. So we discussed a little bit about the new product coming out, a very little. There's not a, like, huge breaking news there, but we talk about it, what's coming down the pipeline. And of course we talk about just the brands in general. Benriach, honestly, find Benriach in Houston, find Benriach near you, try it out. It's absolutely phenomenal at a great price point, and I'm happy with it. So this episode is clearly sponsored by what's in front of you, but beyond the fact that they're sponsors of the show, I'm just a huge fan of them. So we're also going to talk I need to mention this. So Production Jack over there, unless you guys can come up with a better name. I've been told that I don't talk about this aspect of the show enough, so I'm going to talk about it now. This show is available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, YouTube. Facebook's where we get most of our attention. We see most of our viewership there. But download Whiskey Neat on iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher. Basically, most podcast apps have this show. Additionally, what else? Did I miss anything? That was it? Yeah. All right. So I'll also mention the Houston Whiskey Social. So we have been putting on a whiskey festival here in Houston for several years now, and every year we try to go bigger and better, not for the sake of saying we're bigger and better, but for the sake of doing something that no one else is doing. I'm a big supporter of all events here in Houston that are worth your time, Whiskeys of the World, the Whiskey Extravaganza, but we really have tried to put together an event that is doing a lot of uncharted territory. So if you haven't already, I will tell you this. The Houston Whiskey Social is the event sold out last year, and we're definitely tracking to hit that same mark this year. If you haven't gotten your tickets yet, I encourage you, go get your tickets. The event itself is one of the cheapest events in town, and we're doing twice the amount of whiskeys that anyone else is doing, and we're seeing stuff going back decades. We've got a couple of things that no one else is doing, including a bunch of single barrels. So Houston is going through a little bit of a single barrel renaissance. Like, everyone loves a great store pick or hand-selected barrel. We're going to be featuring more than 30 of those at this event this year. So come, if you've heard about certain picks, come try them out. HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. The tickets are on Eventbrite. We've got a few surprises in store, specifically for our guests. So HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. It'll be July 28th. The tickets are up on Eventbrite. I think I've beat that to death, but thank you, guys. So without further ado, Stuart Buchanan. It's just us today, me and him. Best friends, BFFs forever. Yeah, he's 22 years? 25 years?
When was that? It was Christmas 93, so it was 24. So, yeah. 24 years, I think that
24
is.
24 years drinking whiskey and traveling the world.
I was in production most of that time, so I actually left production in 2012. So all of my kind of industry from that 94 period
was from production standpoint.
Yeah, it was all production. And that's why I love traveling, because if you think about me being locked in distillery for 20 years, when they finally let me loose in 2012 to travel the world.
You haven't stopped.
I just love it. And that's why I love. I love seeing people enjoying the whiskey that we've put a lot of efforts into in the distillery. So you can see all your work just coming to fruition.
What you said you worked in production at what distillery?
It started off in Tobermory Distillery, hometown distillery. So that was my local town. And then when Billy Walker, the previous owner to Brown & Forman, started up in Rieich in 2004, he gave myself and our current distillery manager of all three distilleries, Alan McConaughey, we moved from Tobermory to really get Benriach up and running again.
So even from a, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Ralphie, you know Ralphie, the reviewer.
Did we hat.
So, yeah, so you see a lot of, when looking at product, if you're new to whiskey and you're trying to decide what to try, there's a lot of, what's the opposite of a red flag? A green light, just on the label. So non-chill filtered, natural color.
Yeah, yeah.
And even seeing that little bump from 80 proof to 86 is a big... Mm-hmm. It's a little sign, like a little indicator. Right. Like there's a little bit extra given above and beyond what you have to.
Definitely.
And that's something that is always a right then and there. Then you hit the right price point. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to try it.
And I always put that out. Not even so much the chill filtered natural leather, which is very important. But I think some people forget about looking to the strength. And that's what I think we've always done very well is. It's not just flatlined at one strength. Every single bottling will have its own wee hot spot and strength to get that balance in the whiskey. Because you always want that. You want a sweet whiskey, or not a sweet whiskey, but the sweet start. You don't want it overwhelming, but make sure the alcohol is just in enough ratio to give you that lovely click in the middle.
Meaning that everything that you guys put out is specific. You set it at the alcohol proof that you feel is the best for that spirit.
Yep, 100%. And you'll see that across the whole range, how it'll move from 40s to 43s to 46 to 48s, purely on what we hit the balance that we were looking for in that whiskey.
In this 10-year-old, it's 86 proof. To me, it drinks a little bit more, I don't want to say hot in a negative sense, but it does, it's a bit more robust in the mouth than it sounds very snooty, robust.
I know exactly what you mean. Because actually what we're looking for, if you think about Benriach itself, is the new make spirit, the new form spirit is very sweet. It's got this lovely apple pear note and a kind of syrupy nature through it. So sometimes we have to use that strength to give us that contrast in the middle. And actually the cask combination, so the cask combination we're using here is to create this pitch. So I always think you want this lovely start, even soft pitch in the middle, but come up, give you a click, give you a wee bit of vibrancy, bit of, not aggression, but just make sure you know you're drinking whiskey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then that shouldn't get too aggressive. What that should do is then break and lead into this really long, soft finish again. And I think that's the exact profile of this whiskey. I think the colour as well, when you look at the colour of it, I describe the colour very much like the palate. It's bright, it's fresh, it's crisp. And I also use this word zingy. It's like zinginess to it.
Yeah, you referred to it as... warmer climate whiskey, and I would agree completely. Yeah. It's a light, a much more brighter. You said zingy, zesty. Is another zesty word. Yeah, 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 just yeah, like yeah. A nice bright
That's right.
Sharpness to it.
Yeah, And I was actually just recently up in Scottsdale before coming down to Texas. And, you know, think about the heat of
Arizona.
Heat of Phoenix in Scottsdale. This is people just all over it. You know, you've got that lovely freshness, which is, you know, it's freshening to the palate. And there was one gentleman I was speaking to, and he says it's one of his favourite happy hour whiskies when he's serving behind the bar, because in a warm afternoon, happy hour starts. This is an easy whiskey to explain to people, and when they taste it with that freshness, it's not a late night sipping whiskey, I don't think.
Yeah. You know, it's like a digestif. Like, yeah. It's not an after dinner whiskey. It's my daytime, fresh
on the deck. You know. Enjoying it with friends, because it's a very social whiskey as well. I've got different whiskies that I'll drink socially, and then ones I want to sit back my own, or not my own, but in a smaller, more relaxed, laid back way.
Different occasions. Yeah. I actually opened this bottle on Easter Sunday here locally with my brother-in-law. He had been working on roasting some chickens in the heat, mm-hmm. outside. He was doing it in the garage inside of a little oven thing, a rotisserie. But we popped it right then and there, and it was one of those, just like you said, it's one of those summer drinks, mm-hmm. and it's nice and bright, and it does definitely let you know you're drinking whiskey. This is not water.
But also, what I love about it, see, if you're sitting sipping this, it's again. I think a good whiskey should continue to change every time you go back to the palate. And what that first sip for me is that lovely, fresh, bright, zingy zestiness. But see, sip after sip, that middle zestiness maybe mellows and exposes more of the riper fruit note coming through it. So after you go through maybe the one dram, before you know it, you've forgotten about this kind of crisp, maybe strength. It turns into almost, I sometimes say, just like lovely, it's almost apple juice. You know, the orchard
the
fruit
deeper,
note.
The deeper really notes of an apple.
Another thing I also love about the Benrie, especially when you're using this cask combination, I think it shows the barley off very well. Because, again, you've got to remember the only thing we make the whiskey is whiskey
with barley.
and water. And I think barley shows up at the very back of the palate. So when you kind of break that palate down, it's got a lovely sweet interaction at the start, that lovely fresh, bright zestiness in the middle. And then when it tails back into this long finish, for me, at the end of the palate, it goes back to the barley sugars. The barley, I think, is very prominent. And for me, that's good, honest example of single malt. You're not just driven by the cask too much. You're not driven by overpowering it with the cask. You're making sure you can still taste that production of single malt whiskey.
What kind of barrels are you guys using for this?
It's actually a three cask combination, and it's actually, we're looking at using, again, American oak bourbon barrels for that sweeter note. There is a little bit of new oak, virgin oak in there, and the virgin oak is slowly toasted to expose some of the spices. So that little click in the middle is going to come from the new oak, the virgin oak.
Right.
And then I always describe it as a, every ratio will be different, but the sherry, there's a touch of sherry in here, but I don't think the sherry is a prominent palate. I always call the sherry almost the teardrop that will be the glue which binds other flavors together.
That's what you were talking about.
This rolling finish.
The riper fruit flavors.
Yeah.
Those, I always call them Christmas flavors. Your pecan pies, your dark sugars, I don't like to say fruit cake, but baked fruit notes, those really deepened fruit notes.
And it just helps. I think it helps, again, even for a 10-year-old, the great viscosity. When you look at the viscosity of this whiskey, it's a big 10-year-old in the palate.
It's absolutely delicious, and it's reasonably priced. It's just tasty.
Yep.
It gives you a little numbness to the tongue, for sure. And God, just gorgeous. A gorgeous bottle.
Again, I love that color. Again, that emphasizes for me the same as the palette. Again, that bright, zesty character.
It's what Speyside's famous for.
It is. And I think, you know, you look historically, I know that, you know, regionality of whiskey is changing all the time with different distilleries doing different things, as we do, you know, with peat in Speyside.
Yeah.
But I do think this is a great example of maybe historically what a Speyside whiskey would have been, with that lovely, sharp, crisp, sweeter fruit notes running through it.
Definitely no complaints. And you guys do a peated version of this that you said was your favorite.
The Curiositas.
You brought it to you brought it, I want to say, in September, October. But we invited a bunch of people from our little group, and you did this incredible presentation, and we got to try through. I think a lot of times people, as you mentioned, the spotlight a lot of times on Glendronach, but there's this other side of Ben Riick is I don't want to say the underdog. It doesn't get enough attention when it's such a bright and robust spirit. Yeah. I always recommend it to people because, you know, you've got this spectrum. Someone says, I need a bottle recommendation. My first question is, well, how much do you want to spend?
Yeah.
Right. So where are you on the spectrum? Well, under 40, over 40, under 60, under 100. And you can hit every single note from y'all's products. You can hit Ben Riig, you can hit Glendronic, and even up on the higher end, this 21 is, and the Allardyce too, are some of the most deeply sherried Christmas flavors that are just fantastic.
Which actually, another thing is, but I think Ben Riig, you know, some people nowadays, people want to find that little hidden gem, you know. Again, Glendronic's popularity is probably more well known as a brand because it's always been in the market. You know, historically, it's always been in the market, whereas Ben Riig was really only taken into the single malt shelf space in 2004 when we first opened up to the distillery again. So it was actually, prior to that, it was always blending use.
Yeah.
So we were the first ones to take it onto the shelf. So that's why it's maybe a little bit less known in historically.
So you guys used to blend, basically produce product only to blend
off. Well, that was under the previous owners, you know, going right back to the 60s when it was Glenlivet, then Seagram's and Pernod Ricard. If you think about it as well, that, you know, how the fruit balance in there, if you were a blender, you would actually have different stills making different styles of whiskey,
right,
and that massive blender would pull them together. We were lucky that we brought the fruit bomb. So this is a fruit bomb element that would have gone into some of those blends.
I think another one of those brands that was doing that, and the only thing I can say with even a remote Scottish accent was, and I'll try this out, you know, for the first time on air, Craigellachie.
Yeah.
This is the only one but they were doing that too, right? They used to blend off, and I think now they're producing their own.
Yeah, I would say actually probably 99% of distilleries always did that also.
It's not
just unique to us. It's
I know Boonehaven did for a lot of you know, blenders and stuff. Yeah. I didn't think it was a.
No, you could probably put 99% of distilleries in that bracket.
And then now they're producing their own stuff.
Yeah.
And again, I think you guys definitely hit the mark with this. And this is not just. I'm gonna have a little bit more before we move on.
Well, it's good because after you can see how that progresses, and you really see that. I think the riper fruits elevate, and when we talk about the older vintages as well, you know, we've got some fantastic old Glendronic cask going back to 1968, Glenglassaugh will go back to 1963, Ben Riig will go back to 1966.
That's another great one too, by the way.
Yeah, what I think. See, if you were to taste Ben Riig's, I love. There's a wee hot spot that people went crazy for was the 1976 Ben Riig's. I don't know why one writer kind of captured that one and did a lot of publicity for it, and it just went through the roof. So 76, they're all fantastic years, but for some reason 76 was really hooked onto. And if you taste that, goodness, it's almost like tropical fruits, mangoes, papayas, passion fruit, overripe black bananas. The fruit balance as Ben Riig gets older in its vintages, it just goes through the roof. And that's why I think the honesty of that spirit is fantastic, just letting that fruit develop.
You mentioned Glenglassaugh, Glenglassaugh,
yep.
Right? Glenglassaugh. So I've had a few things from them. Most of my experience has been Glendronic and Ben Riig. You mentioned a hot spot, 1976.
That's one year that everybody picks up, and I wouldn't put that in a year. I think every year is fantastic. Sure. But there was a lot of raving about 1976.
I think the same thing happens with 93 and 95 for the Glendronic.
Yeah, and also 72 for some reason stands out.
I haven't had the pleasure of trying 72 Glendronic, but
you can almost walk on it that way. Is that
real thick? Yeah. So the 93 95 Glendronics, and we even recently talked about doing a barrel of that because I know that they had a program that had recently rolled out. But it's just you've got your where this is like 0 to 100 in the fruit scale, or dark ripe fruit scale. This is like right there in the middle, and like you said, it's got that nice bright, and then it's got a lot of honey going on, a lot of that deep dark honey,
heather honeys. And again, it's different fruits. I always put them in two categories. You know, if you think about Speyside and American oak, you'll be accentuating the riper white fruits, and then sherry, you'll be accentuating the darker stone fruits and the Mediterranean fruits.
If I'm not mistaken, I know that Glendronic does well with bourbon drinkers. So do you guys see a lot of crossover between Benriach and the bourbon world as far as their...
It's quite funny you mentioned that, because we were thinking it might be the opposite way around. I think coming to the States, you would almost assume that because the Benriach is majority American oak, that would be the one that would fit in the palate of the American whiskey drinker. But as even last night down in San Antonio, I get that all the time, that 12-year-old Benriach, Glendronach particularly, bourbon drinkers are liking that for the intensity of that richness.
I've said this a thousand times in various interviews and on the show, that our palates are so acclimated to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
We love our sweetness. And for some reason, both aesthetically and on the palate, your Glendronachs, your Sherry Bombs are so closely related to what people expect from bourbon, especially with the higher proof, that I think we do naturally prefer the Sherry Bombs. Even Glenfiddich did their Bourbon Reserve, and I know at least in the bourbon world, Glendronach is a great introduction to Scotch. Yeah. That's the biggest thing I've had to battle with, because I started off with, personally, I started off as a Scotch guy, and we've got this local bourbon group, and there's just not that many Scotch drinkers. I'm like, well, have you tried this? Have you tried that?
Yeah.
You guys hit the nail on the head with your cash strength offerings.
Yeah, indeed. Fantastic.
If you want to win over a bourbon drinker, a really heavy bourbon drinker, a really prejudiced bourbon drinker, a cash strength Scotch offering is the way to go.
And I think that's probably, I'm trying to think how long it would have been, but you look at American whiskeys getting older in the barrel as well. Maybe that wasn't always the case, if it was 10 years ago or so, but definitely there's more older aged bourbons coming out now with such an intensity to it. I keep getting that feedback of Glendronach, being that bourbon to single malt drinker.
You're not supposed to talk about Fight Club, but the there's this market online of buying and trading when it comes to bottles. And I keep seeing, Allardyce, the Parliament, I'm seeing more of the Sherry Bombs. In fact, I think Glendronach did something, Glenn Glassop might have did something too. Didn't you guys do something? I know Glendronach did something with a Kingsman.
That's right, Kingsman movie. Yeah.
There wasn't a Glenn Glassop version.
No,
it was just Glendronach.
Glendronach, then Old Forester did their Statesman.
Yeah.
And we did the Kingsman.
We did the Statesman last week. No complaints.
Yeah.
It's a solid drink.
And that was a nice wee project working in that. It was quite fun. Quite fun.
Did you get to do anything like?
I watched a movie about 15 times before it was released. So I was at every premiere and preview down in London with the Kingsman edition, and by God, that went down well.
That first movie was the only complaint I had with it, and this is completely off topic. Was we've been having this debate recently with a bunch of friends about how you have unnecessary things that happen in films, and Samuel L. Jackson had this stupid accent the entire film that was just it was just awful. It was an unnecessary lisp. So this phenomenal film, but
that was your annoyance.
It was my annoying thing. My production guy Jack just pointed out we've got a quick break here for a second. You want to move on to the Allardyce?
Yep.
Do you like to do it, even though I know they're supposed to be different in stages, the 18 and the 21, do you like to do it in that order? Or do you?
I just go like that. I'll work from light to dark.
46, 48, I guess it would be the natural progression in proof.
Yep.
I normally gauge it based off profile and proof. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if obviously if you're drinking a peated whiskey, you don't want that to be.
That's right.
You want it to be the last one.
It's funny you say that, because actually yesterday, and quite often, if I'm doing a lineup of our single malts, I sometimes don't mind sticking a peated in the middle. Because I think with the Benriach peaks or even the Glenglassett peak, it's not going to blow your palate away. You can happily take a wee break and normally get some food, people can rinse their palate, and you can go on without overly affecting it. So I quite like sticking sometimes a wee peat. But that's particularly to our peat, or being softer and slightly sweeter.
In general, in my day-to-day life, I'll often bounce around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind drinking Lagavulin and then switch to Laphroaig and then maybe something shared. But if I'm doing a tasting and trying to introduce something, introduce people to something new, like a big bourbon, I try to keep to that natural progression.
That's right. Makes
just
it easier.
It makes a little.
But you know what I love doing? If I've got we do something good with 6-7 whiskies, and sometimes that poor wee first whiskey at the start gets forgotten about a little bit. Or even if it's the first whiskey you've had in different palates with the freshness, it maybe not quite settled your palate yet. So I'll always go through, but then go back to the first one, taste it, see it's changed. You know, is your body get used to the alcohol now? Is it going to change something? So I'll never take that opinion in the first sip of the whiskey. It'll always be take another couple of sips or go to another whiskey, come back to it again, see how your palate's changed. And I love how people just kind of open their eyes up. So, oh, God, that's totally different now, you know? And it can change a whiskey dramatically.
When I introduce someone to something new that I know is going to be, you know, a big thing that if you've got someone who's a bourbon drinker and you introduce them to a scotch or even a brandy or a cognac, they're closely related, but they're vastly different spirits a lot of times. So yeah. I always tell them to sit down with someone like this and drink through half a bottle with somebody, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, not necessarily one night, but
normally that stuff, our stuff goes down that well, it normally does happen.
Yeah, but I've been across from someone drinking some spirit that's completely off profile, and a lot of times even Texas whiskeys are kind of known to be completely different than Kentucky whiskey. So we'll sit here and we'll drink, and you'll acclimate to what that bottle is trying to present to you. And so I guess what I would say is for those who are listening and aren't familiar with something like even rum, we're big rum drinkers lately.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of us will, you know, sit down with the bottle, approach it the exact same way in a Glencairn or in a tulip shaped glass to kind of smell and get that nose, and then sit you know, have a conversation with somebody, sit through it, maybe have a couple of bites to eat, and then it'll change, it'll open up, and you'll approach it differently.
And I think as well, when I talk about, you know, how people taste, how I personally taste whiskey, so I never tell people how they should taste whiskey because it's up to every individual to do so, but I always think about deconstructing it. So it's never to try and think about the whole whiskey as one big picture. It's almost like, okay, I'm going to concentrate on one thing just now. So let me concentrate on just the fruit. What fruit is it? Sip after sip, just fruit. What fruit is it? And then next thing, what spice am I getting? Is it a white pepper? Is it a black pepper? Is it a chili pepper? Is it, you know, what kind of heat am I getting?
Try to pick it apart.
Yeah. And then at the end, what am I getting in the finish? You know, is the fruit elevated? Is it got more stewed? Is it got lighter? And is there barley there? So it's almost like dissecting it down. Almost, I always do the wee graph.
Right.
And seeing each of these segments, how it changes. And that for me, is a good whiskey should do that. It should be open enough to be able to taste the 20 seconds at last, the 30 seconds at last. And I do count in my head sometimes. I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, what's now 6, 7, 8, 9, 10? And you actually count in seconds the change of that whiskey. And that's what I love about just sitting, sipping away slowly, getting all these changes.
Now, did you – I know that Pedro, who's off camera, no one can see him, but I know he just got back from Scotland. Were you with him?
Unfortunately not. I had actually some commitments out here already. So I was out at the Nth Whiskey Festival in Vegas, and a couple of things in Scottsdale to do. So I had to come out. Unfortunately, I couldn't host the guys back home. I had been in some previous
tours with them.
But actually, I think between March and end of April, I think there's at least over 100, there must be at least 100 people from Brown-Forman coming to Scotland over the 2 months.
Do you guys do it every year? It's like a...
This is really the first with the ownership, you know. I think it's hugely important to get the Brown-Forman guys over, all the sales team and the partners in distribution, get them over to feel the soul of the distilleries.
Yeah, it's a big part of what you're doing in selling the product is believing in it.
Yeah.
Nobody wants someone who read a couple of hit notes on a piece of paper trying to sell it at a bar. I know a lot of brands will at least make it a requirement of a yearly pilgrimage back to Scotland, which is just... It's got to be the best part of your job, man. I mean, come on. And
that's it. You do feel the soul. And you see the scale. You know, I think scales are very important as well. I think one of the things Pedro came away with just yesterday was couldn't believe how few people it takes to run all our distilleries. You know, it's like you go around there.
And they supply for the whole world.
Yeah, and it's just such a gentle place. It's almost a calming effect when you walk around the facilities. It's just murmuring away. Blah, 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 blah. There's not a big rush or panic or clanging and banging.
Yeah.
It's just such a peaceful environment to be in.
It's a bit different here in the bourbon realm because it is usually a much more real estate. You know, Jack Daniels takes up so much property, you know, and you've been there too. I think I saw recently a photo of you standing next to Jack. And it's every time I've been to Scotland and every distillery we visited just seemed like it was their downtime, but it wasn't. It was just there. Yeah. It was just a peaceful existence.
Yeah, it really is.
Now, this comes out every year, the Glendronic 18.
Yeah, that's actually in our core range all the time.
I just don't, we don't see it as often, and if you do, it's a surprise, a pleasant mm-hmm. surprise. But these two here, I think you guys could not have done a better job with. And that's and yes, you guys are big supporters of me, but I could not say this enough, and anyone who knows Glendronic knows it, at least from a fanboy perspective, it's just freaking good. Yeah. You know, it's just good stuff.
It is, and it's old school. You know, it's just doing things right, old school way. And actually, the palette's old school as well. You know, I think that richness, the spice, the depth, the viscosity, everything about it screams old school style whiskey.
I wanted to ask you: is there a touch of peat in this?
No, but there's a weird thing that happens actually. Now, you can't analyse it, but it's a bit geeky. But actually, all the Rosso barrels, naturally, there's a higher natural phenolic value in Spanish oak than American oak. So with a long time in Spanish oak, what you'll try to find, like some red wines, you know, you've got smokiness out
Pedro
of that
Menace.
Wine. Yeah. And by just maturing in good sherry casks, there are some of these natural phenolic values that will pull into the whiskey over time. So same as you get some smoky red wines, same thing. They're pulling some of that smoke from the oak as well.
It's something that I know Bolvene, they have just a touch of peat in their, and oftentimes you won't notice it. But in these deep sherry bombs, there is that touch of smokiness there, but it's not, obviously it's not from peat.
No, and also you've got to think anything prior to 1996 would have been using a ratio of floor malted barley and bought in barley. So the floor malting ceased production in 1996 at Glendronach. So I don't know if that's the case, but again, that combination of a bit of floor malted barley along with the bought malt barley, is that floor malted barley going to bring a little bit more of that smoke? Possibly.
Well, no complaints here.
Yeah,
if you guys ever need help on these visits to the distillery, you let me know.
And I think as well, when you see Glendronach in the glass, that lovely, it's almost that kind of polished mahogany, rich dark notes, and then the viscosity, gee whiz, it just holds onto the glass. It almost turns the glass into a stained glass window, how that holds on.
We typically have three people on the show, and I actually invited on a good friend of mine who is also one of your big supporters, Michael Canfield. He couldn't make it, but he would have just died to be here. And knowing him, he probably would have brought some single cask bottling from, you know, years back. But it's just, you're doing everything right. No complaints whatsoever. God, now I want that 21.
Yeah, that's good.
So let me ask you, what's the one side of this constant globetrotting that just kills you? Don't you miss home at all?
Nope.
You're happy being around?
Not at all. I can't even look after a houseplant. I don't even want to look after a houseplant. I'll just travel
around.
No pets
in your life.
Yeah,
and...
No. And that's a great thing. I strip my life down to the most simplest existence. I could probably live out a suitcase all year round. It wouldn't bother me. I'm not a possessions person. Although I do like my cars, my motorbikes. So I do miss my motorbikes and my cars, but that's about the only thing.
How many miles a year do you, it's got to be less than 100 with as little as your home.
Well, I must admit, yeah. And actually, I'll take any opportunity to get out and drive. And that's why when I'm back at home, I live in Edinburgh at the moment, but I'll drive 180 miles, 3 hours, door to door from my house to distilleries. And I'll do that with pleasure 3-4 times a week because I just love that drive.
In Houston, we're known for our just awful commute.
I think most places in the States, I've seen that lately.
Yeah, but the open road with no stopping and going and bumping it, you know, no bumper to bumper, is I don't mind it at all. You give time to listen to this podcast
the scenery mile by mile in Scotland. I think that's even the feedback you get. If you're driving from Edinburgh, you know, central Britain, whether it's Edinburgh or Glasgow, and you're driving up to Speyside or the Highlands, every 30
especially
mile,
right up the middle,
it's just
up and down.
It changes so much. You can go through the kind of real kind of farming fields, then you can go into the forest areas, then you go up to the mountains and the craggy and the rocks and the landscape and the moors, and then back into the farming landscape again. Every 30 miles, it just keeps on changing, and I love that.
We stayed in an abbey, like an old church in Loch Ness.
Yep.
And then we drove.
Did you see Nessie?
So, no. We drove as much whiskey as we drank. I didn't see anything. But we drove straight through coming back down to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And we had to go several times, like less than, I don't know what the kilometer difference is, but about 15 miles an hour. You're going real slow.
We do miles. Good, good.
So we, you guys are such a steep, and your ears would pop because you guys are hitting way up there, and the roads are real narrow, but it was one of the most beautiful landscapes we've seen.
Well, thinking of that road, was it the road over like
we drove through Dufftown. We drove through Dufftown, and we passed by a few distilleries.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's basically just peaks and valleys, peaks and valleys.
And there's a wee ski resort on the side as well.
Mosquitoes?
A ski resort.
Maybe it was that? It was in the fall, so I didn't see any.
I know that one. I know the road.
Yeah, so it was a unbelievably beautiful landscape, and then of course we would stumble on distilleries lying there. So what's the oldest distillery in Scotland? It's one of the glens.
Not quite remember who claims to have the oldest licensed.
It's at the. I have the picture of it in my mind. It's white with purple on it.
Oh no, it's not. That might be Tom O'Toole, no.
No, that's white with purple label. Although I have something for you on the way out. Remind me, I've got something for you downstairs that's got Tom O'Toole's name on it. But I forget the name of it. But we would stumble upon some distilleries on the way through, because once you get through Dufftown and you start heading towards Edinburgh, it's just nothing but like parks, just beautiful land, and
I never get sick of it.
And yet you're just glow. Have you ever been to Asia?
Actually, funnily enough, I just came straight back from Asia. I was in, where did we go? Korea, Hong Kong, Korea, Singapore. Come back to Scotland for 2 days and back out here again. That was basically my last month has been split between Asia and here.
The plane rides, it's got to be the biggest headache in the job. You don't mind it either.
I can sleep in a knife edge.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And if I can get my body into the flight system quite well, so I'll stay up all night somewhere, just don't go to bed, we can't nap on the side. As soon as I got on that flight, I'll dribble my way through service, fall asleep, wake up on the other side, and I'm ready to go.
So it might be similar to that in shift work, because in my background, you get used to the overnights. If you just acclimate, you find your pattern and you stick to it.
And I think you're right, and I think that's why, for myself, coming from production, I've actually worked shift work since I started when I was 23 or whatever it was. So my body's never had a routine body clock. It's always been all over the place.
Always gotten used to it. We may have touched on this. I know we did before the show. Let's talk the Glendronach 15 coming back out. So what do we know, the who, what, when, where? And
I'll quite happily admit, absolutely nothing. Although we know it's going to come back at some point.
Same packaging? Yeah. Green revival?
I don't know, because do you know something? I think because we now have the Glenglassaugh revival, we don't want to complicate that. So Glenglassaugh's got the revival expression.
Right.
So we maybe we'll have to just work on another name, a header name for that. We've been looking since, you know, obviously since the distillery reopened again in 2002. We've always kept track of that maturation, seeing what's happening through the years. And there are casks that we know that are reaching that same point where the old 15 was, with that lovely, I call it sometimes a mushroomy, earthy palate. Or even, the best we can describe it is like walking into a Dunnage warehouse. There was something about the 15 that had this kind of earthiness, there was a darkness to it. And we've found that in the production.
That's already taken by something, right? The darkness.
Oh no, no, yeah.
There's a few Scott with it, so you can't do that.
No, but there was a Dunnagey note in there. So I don't know what. And again, we'll leave that to Rachel or the brand team to decide, I'm sure.
Like
maybe I'll stick with revival. I'm not quite sure.
So it's and as many people know, there was a fan base fanaticism that came with the 15 people. Ralphie was a big pusher.
Globally.
He called it the whiskey of the year for 2016 or 2017. One of the most just awesome. I mean, hit the nail on the head. Yeah. Right price point, right? Because that's a big part of it, right? You can have a phenomenal spirit, but it's not the right price point as far as daily availability.
And that's the weird thing as well, what I thought, because palates globally change. You know, if I'm in Asia, palates are different. If I'm in Eastern European markets, the palate's different. In America, the palate's different. But that 15 globally hit the nail on the head. And the funny thing was, it wasn't hugely overly sherried. It was almost like pulling back a little bit on the sherry and letting that little bit of funk come through from the distillery.
Do we know that the proof will be the same?
I would imagine so. I think, if I remember rightly, it was at 46, I think, so the 92 ABV on that. But Rachel will totally work on that and maybe put her own thing on it as well. So
we're going to get the bottle when the first hits Texas. We'll get it on the show. All right. It's something that, like, as...
I'm looking forward to it.
One of millions. I was definitely a huge fan of it.
And it is going to create such a buzz. And we'll definitely launch it well. So once we get everything in, and I think we didn't want to rush it because, funnily enough, we could have probably done it at the start of this year because the whiskey was then 15. But there was no rush. So let's just do it and do it right.
Don't rush it.
There's never any rush to do it. Again, because the thing is, you put something out too soon.
Then you burn bridges.
Yeah, so let's just give it a bit more time.
Jump the shark.
Let's give it more time. Make sure we get that right and the combination right together. So really looking forward to it, though. And by goodness, I'm going to be busy when it does launch. I'll be all over the world again.
When it hits, it's going to be all over the place. So, all right, so we'll take a little quick break and we'll come back. So we're expecting it in the fall sometime. The Glendronic 15-ish. Maybe winter, maybe the beginning of next year. Because I know when I had first
with
talked...
With a good wine behind us, you would hope so. But there's a lot in the pipeline. Even with Benria, we've got a lot of new launches and there's other things happening. We've got single cask batches come out around about December, around about the fall as well. And I don't think you want anything to... We need to find a gap where there's not going to be other... products launching, you know, that's going to be...
You don't want to pile them up.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. We want to make sure. I think nowadays, previously, we would bring a lot of things into the market. And I think that was quite confusing for a lot of people with both Benriach and Glendronach sometimes. You know, you have an extension coming out every month or something else. But I think we do want to kind of put more strategy into it now and make sure that when anything new comes out, it's focused, it's done right.
You give them their own space, their own stage.
Exactly, and it's not just superseded by something straight away. So the team will just have to build that strategy when they think that best spot to...
When we had first talked a few months ago, we had talked about the having it released in June. And I knew going into that it was everything else gets just pushed back. So I would imagine, and knowing Texas, how we get everything less, that we probably won't see it till the beginning of next year. But
not sure, actually. But again, what I would like to do, if I was actually in charge of getting out in the market, I would actually choose it to be around a big festival. You know, make sure it was getting launched at one of the festivals. And
festival's in July.
And that means you can really highlight it to a big consumer base, you know.
Launch it appropriately.
That's right. And you've got guys here that are going to be thirsty for it coming in. That's what I would do if I was going to launch any product.
I had a question for you, but I'm going to save it to the end. It's a stupid question.
No such thing as a stupid question when it comes to whiskey.
Give me a few more drinks in me. I'll jump the gun and ask. So it's one of those things. You said you don't know if they'll change anything on it or if they'll keep the same name. You did mention that there's going to be other stuff coming out.
Yeah, Benriach got some lovely changes to the lineup. Rachel's been doing some fantastic work in warehouses and, you know, trying to build that consistency of what Benriach is doing. So the Benriach, we're moving the 25 Authenticus to a 30. There's 21 Peated coming out, Temporis. The 20's also moving, Classic's moving to 21. So there's a lot of movement going on. And we're just trying to build stability going forward that we know that this will be the continual range. So there's lots of things happening. And above that, as I'm sure you know, we do our single cask batches as well. So we need to fit them in along the way and make sure they're getting treated right in their own respect. Normally they're okay because they fly off the shelf with them being quite limited allocations.
It's a tough market here for those, particularly because of our taxes. Mm-hmm. And there are there are overseas companies who will ship here, and so a lot of people, when those hit, they go nuts. They buy it. Now it's an expensive shipping thing, but overall the cost is a lot cheaper. Yeah, so it's just TBC is a problem. Our taxes in general are a problem. Our import taxes. It's an unfortunate side of it, but where there's a will, there's a way, and they always it flies off the shelf immediately.
Yeah.
So anything, you mentioned that moving to a 21, anything, and you're talking about in the Benriach line, is there anything happening in the Glenglassa?
No, Glenglassa, where are we with Glenglassa? Back home, actually, in Glenglassa, more people are just familiar with the core range Glenglassas being the Torfa, Evolution, and Revival, which are three fantastic.
I had the Revival the other day. I picked some up.
Really funky wee distilleries. Whiskies from the distillery. But back home, actually, we have octave casks, small runs of limited octaves that go into bottling. We've got virgin oak barrels. We've got some port finish. I don't know if they'll ever come to the US, but I hope. We do want to build some extensions off of Glenglassa, and they are happening globally, and it should, well, they should come to the US as well at some point.
Are there any US releases planned, or the US only? Like, you know, I know some bourbons will do like a...
Not, but well, again, that's another thing. There's so much happening just now. I think we'll just take one step at
changing.
A time.
Yeah.
We'll take one step at a time.
It's all changing.
But I'll tell you, just to touch on Glenglassa, Glenglassa has been a little rock star. It really has. And I think it's even caught the Brown-Forman sales guys by surprise. We used to go in with it. We would concentrate on the Benriach and the Glendronach, being, you know, that kind of older age whiskies and the classic kind of Speyside and Highlands. Little Glenglassa kind of ran away with itself and almost carved its own path in some ways, because there's something about Glenglassa palate. Now, maybe it's actually not aimed at it, but maybe the new consumer to single malt whiskies, or people who have never tasted single malt whiskey before, they find something in Glenglassa very unique.
What's the core? Is the same? What do you do with proof in the Glenglassa line?
Well, funnily enough, the two sweeter expressions, one being the Evolution, which is all Tennessee whiskey barrels, and the other being Torfa, which is majority Tennessee whiskey barrels, and some sherry, they're both at 100 proof.
When you say Tennessee whiskey barrels, can we assume?
We can assume that, yes.
Okay, yeah, okay. You know what I was going to say.
And
Tennessee bourbon barrels.
But you know something? These two, especially I've got sweet tooth myself. That's what I go for. These are just awesome. Again, simple whiskies, but they seem to be, again, they're capturing people's attention. With Glenglassa, I've started calling this the Glenglassa eyebrow, or actually one of my colleagues started actually, but we have Glenglassa in front of us and somebody will say, I've never heard of Glenglassa, and I'm like, oh, don't worry, because again, it's been shut most of its lifetime, not a lot of people have.
Yeah.
And they'll nose Glenglassa, then this kind of nose, then this eyebrow will come up. Yeah. What's happening here? So people just seem to be intrigued by it. Yeah. And again, it's that little hidden gem that, you know, people want to find and discover in their own right, rather than having a big, you know, whiskey forced down their
neck. Can you point me in the direction of some stores in Houston that has it? I know of a store that's got the Revival. I had that, and I thought it was fascinating. I think I even tasted at the maybe Whiskeys of the World here in Houston. Mm-hmm. For the next month, well, that'll be what I focus on. I'm such a big fanatic of trying something new.
Well, it will blow you away.
And I talk about it every episode, how you've got to get outside your comfort zone. And even some of the different world whiskeys, you know, Cavillon makes a tremendously sherry.
Been there many times.
Heavy bomb, right? But there's even some Pindrin. There's some Swedish whiskeys out there that are, you know, in other countries. And I always mess this one up, but is it pronounced Sven Five Star? Or
I'm not familiar.
It's
with
like
that
a, it's like in a beaker, like in a, not a beaker, but like a.
Oh yes,
yes, it's the kind of pyramid, gold, kind of with copper, a gold wax,
yeah,
with
copper
a copper
wax. Yeah, yeah. I do the one you mean.
So yes. Just trying something new, and I'll be honest with you, most of those other countries are trying to mimic the Speyside, but not quite as good.
That's one thing I like about my job, traveling, because actually, I think it's actually something that's very unique about this business as well, that all us producers of whiskey are all best buddies. So you mentioned Pandern, for example, Wales, Cavillan, Yinchang in Taiwan, the boys, whether it's in Box in Sweden or the one you mentioned I can never pronounce, we travel together all the time. We see these guys more than we see our family.
Yeah.
So we're actually buddies. And that's what I love about whiskey, full stop. I think it's a very unusual industry that way, that we can let the sales guys fight about shelf space, but see, back in base production, we admire what we all do.
There's no equally competitive nature. We had talked about this in the first episode as well, that in the beverage world, even within the, I'm not going to say who, but the two biggest soda producers, when in my day job, I work in aviation, and we handle coordination of private flights and charter flights globally. We're not allowed to book hotels that serve one soda.
Is that right?
When you stay at a hotel, you of course you expense it. It's part of your company credit card or whatever. they're not allowed to book hotels. We actually booked the transportation set up for one crew that, and they had well, I won't say the water company, but there was a water that's owned by a big soda company, and they couldn't get in the car. So it's this weird competitiveness that happens in some industries, but with whiskey, there seems to be this love. And because again, you do see each other at all these events worldwide. You literally travel the world. You'll see the same person in a different country and not even know they're there. You just run into them at the event.
And the weirdest thing, if I'm in Australia or if I'm in Asia, people say, oh, did you manage to go and see Bondi Beach? Did you manage to go and see this gorge and the river and canoe down the river? No. If you want to find me, I'll be at a brewery or a distillery or a gin distillery. I'll be in, it's a busman's holiday for me. If I've got a day off, I'll be at another distillery meeting the guys
and
seeing what they do. I love it.
When we stayed in Isla, we had, Ardbeg has this beautiful little cafe that they built. And we were having lunch at Ardbeg after we had left Lafroig. Mm-hmm. And Lafroig employees were eating lunch at Ardbeg's cafe. Mm-hmm. And it's just weird, like, there's no... Why? There's plenty of room for everybody. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the entire globe. You're not talking about one city that you're trying to fight for the same food or whatever.
And there's a weird thing as well. Every Christmas, everybody's busy throughout the year. Sometimes we don't catch up with each other kind of through the course of like every month. But after Christmas, after New Year, before everybody starts traveling again, I think we're up to about 35 ambassadors in Scotland now that we just have a night out in Glasgow or Edinburgh and just have enjoy our company, you know, everybody's company, and we just have a great night, and then that's us back out traveling the world.
So once a year?
Every Christmas.
Oh, every Christmas.
It's almost a New Year Christmas get-together from all different companies.
That's absolutely awesome. Yeah. And you're like a family.
It is.
Coming back to this Binriac after going through the Glendronach.
It's crazy, isn't it?
It's... What's the price point on this? What are
we... $56.
So
bargain,
bargain, and the nowadays, especially with the I mentioned earlier, the online market for at least bourbon, at least that most new bourbon releases are in that $50 mark. Yeah. Whereas, you know, there's a guy locally that's always told me that Scotch is a rich man's game. Well, no, it's not. There are plenty of Scotches that are now what you'd be paying for some bourbon releases and are at a much older age statement.
Same could be said with gin as well. Even the price of gin's gone up.
Everything's gone up, and it's understandable with Scotch because you've got to deal with those import taxes. But with bourbon, they're just deciding. You know, I mean, there's some factors that go into it, but thankfully, some bourbon distillers are pretty great about it. Not to plug Jack Daniels, but the single barrel is about the $50 mark, but the barrel-proof version of that is only $5 more. Yeah. There's a distillery, a producer in Kentucky whose barrel-proof version of the same exact product is a couple $100 more than their standard shelf item. Yeah. And it's just weird. So you'll find the bourbon producers who release a $55 cash-strength single barrel. I mean, we bought a barrel of it. It's coming in the next 2 weeks. But the Scotch is still sitting in that nice little... Yeah. You can get a ton of them at the $50 mark,
and
$55 mark.
It's made to be drank, you know? Again, like any whiskey that starts maybe getting into the big figures, you wonder actually sometimes how much of that whiskey is going to get opened and drank. Is it going to, you know, is it going to just sit in a cupboard and get looked at? I think that's a great thing about pricing is you hit it right. You buy it, you drink it, you come back and you buy it again.
Yeah.
If it's when you go up in that price, you buy it once and you look at it for the rest of your life.
You find a special occasion for it. But, you know, I think you're going to have that natural progression with, I don't know if we've talked about this, but there's this thing that happens when you first start getting money to collect something like an expensive hobby of whiskey. When you first get into it, you will buy the expensive bottle and you'll sit on it for a while, look for that special occasion. But then you'll eventually, as you begin to backlog and develop a collection of a couple hundred bottles, you realize now you're looking for any reason to drink it. But I'd rather get to it immediately and try something
that's
good.
Right. And then that's it. And how did you find that change? I think that really has elevated the fruits again. It's
correct.
Lost that zingy, bright, crisp
coming
note.
Back to it, I taste more of the... The focus is more on the darker fruits, the ripened fruits, as you say. It's not so much that bright initial palate that I was getting. It reminds me of the light beer. So I'm not a light beer drinker, but when I go to a baseball game mm-hmm. in America or a football game in America, something about that hot day and a nice cold can of something light, it's that crisp freshness. Yeah. It's literally refreshing.
Well, it's funny. My favorite beers are the Belgian Lambic Gouza beers. And you get that Gouza notes, which is that lovely crisp green apple note. I think that's where it starts, like the front side.
That'd be a much better comparison than me saying the light beers, because that's a little bit, a few people may scoff at that. But it's, I mean it in the bright summer day freshness of...
Totally.
It's delicious. You know, and you bring up a good point. So coming back to that dumb question I had, since you're never home, the sad part of your job has got to be the fact that, how do you develop a collection?
Do you know something that's quite easy? When I travel the world, I always come back with, I shouldn't really, but I come back with 4 bottles of different things from all over the world. So basically I put it in the corner of my room. As soon as I start tripping over it, put it in an archive box, put it in the loft. Same thing happens. Trip, trip, trip. Another box full of whiskey, put it up in the loft.
Never home to drink. Exactly. So really you are...
I do not know what I've got up in the loft, because it's all coming in, boom, 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 so quick.
Even can I get written into your will? I feel like you might be sitting on hundreds of...
It was my birthday last week, so I was 47, I think it was. So 50th birthday's approaching, and do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get in, everything's from the loft, have a 4-day party, or... basically, open everything and nobody leaves till it's gone.
That's insane.
So that's reduce that stock.
That's my goal in life is I'm a fairly young buck, but as I develop our family and our home, I want to develop a living space in which I never have to leave. And I want people to come over. You know, there's two kinds of people in the world. You coming home from work and seeing people there that you didn't know were there, you know, like your wife invited someone over, or, you know, and you being upset or you being excited. Mm. And I'm the type of guy that if I come home and we've got family there, let me open something. Let's pour, let's drink, let's talk. And the idea of, like you said, taking a few days off, bringing down what you got and having this big bottle share and just 3-4 days of, I don't know if I could do 3-4 days. I still got a couple of babies.
Yeah.
But
give it a go though.
I can try. But I'll fly to Scotland if someone's hosting.
But even in my house, I don't like having things on display, because it's like, well, I'm traveling in bars every day of the week, so I want to kind of separate my house to be not looking like a bar. So
right.
I'll keep a couple of bottles there just so it'll be my wee daily drinks. But yeah, I'll get everything up in the loft. Boom. And that's it. Yeah, so the Keeper of the Quake is, you know, I hate talking about it as if I'm boasting being awarded.
No, but it's interesting.
So basically you get nominated for just for time in industry and for work of just spreading the love of whiskey globally. So you'll get, you know, people in Taiwan, South Africa, America, you know, people who have supported and, you know, strive for single malt in their working career. Get nominated as a Keeper of the Quake.
How do you spell that?
So a Keeper of the Quake, so I think I'm right in saying Q-U-A-I-C-H.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. So it's the wee sharing cup, that's your Keeper of the Quake. And that was great, because actually they hid it for me for a while. They didn't tell me I was getting nominated, and I was wondering why they were calling me back from Asia so quickly. And I thought, that's unusual, but it was because
you got nominated for
the dinner, so the big banquet.
Who else is in this? So essentially, it's like a Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So who else? You can say that. Who's in the? Who else would we know of? How hard is it to get this thing?
It's just time and service. You just have to, again, you have to be nominated by 2 people, and then it goes then to the governing
body.
Group,
yeah.
And then they decide whether you're worthy enough. And again, it was so humbling to be worthy enough to join. And
where did they give you? Where was your ceremony?
Up in Blairathel. So the big Blairathel Castle there, and that's just, you know,
nice steeped little distillery there too. Yeah,
steeped in history. So it was great to get that. So basically, every major distiller in Scotland would be, if not a Keeper of the Quake, then you become a Master of the Quake as well, and then you get the next higher up the longer time you've been in the industry. But very humbling.
The Harry Potter fan in me is thinking, you know, Master. It sounds very
The knights were fantastic. They really were. the night was just awesome.
Just awesome. Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I really appreciate you coming on. You know, I don't know the next time. How long are you here for?
I leave tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
But we'll be back again, back down here. Not sure of the schedule, but definitely we'll be back down before the end of the year. So
when did you fly in?
This has been a quick trip. It's only 2 weeks. So
just all throughout Texas.
Yeah. No, I was up in Seattle, Portland, Vegas, Scottsdale.
Oh, through America. Yeah. Seattle's got one of the best whiskey, at least on-premise whiskey stuff that in the country.
Portland's pretty funky as well.
So, well, thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure.
I really enjoyed
you.
It. Absolutely. Andrew, had a few drinks with Stuart Buchanan. Cheers.
Cheers. Slash.